topic. So I think last time I gave a talk here, I was also presenting something new that was this relativistic thing. And now I took a complete new and different topic. So I became interested in many-body physics. And well, you know, like it's relevant in most areas in physics, but well, I'm particularly interested in it because of implementing quantum information. It's we all know that ultimately quantum computers will be implemented in many-body systems. So well, the biggest thing that worries me about what we know about many-body physics is that there's very few models which have exact analytical solution. So this makes this really limits our understanding of the system, and it becomes very hard to study their quantum properties and really understand them and understand the interaction of different, like for example, the relationships between entanglement and, I don't know, maybe phase transitions, which is quite an interesting topic, and things like that. So I like my main goal in this area is to construct models which have exact analytical solution. Also, well, you know, with numerical results, you have a number, but you don't really know where it comes from. But also, it's really limited by the number of particles in your system. So the more particles you get, the more difficult it becomes to study the system in this way. And usually, for example, for the sort of systems I will present, you can only do numerical work for up to, I don't know, 100 particles maybe, and then it really becomes very, very difficult. So that was my main idea. So my main project is to find these kind of models. And right now, I'm going to present you an example of where I think that my technique end up being quite successful. So it's really just some mathematical trick that I use, but in the way that I would prepare the present things today, it won't really, well, maybe you can see it, but it will be probably a bit hard to see it, but I will talk about the math behind that at the end. Okay. So this is work done in collaboration with a postdoc in Mexico, Pablo Barberis Blosky. So, well, as the title said, this is how to construct models for multimode Bose-Einstein condensate with exact analytical solution. And what I will do is that I will show you how to do that with the simplest multimode Bose-Einstein condensate, which is the two-mode Bose-Einstein condensate. So I'll describe that system in detail. And then I will make a short discussion on inelastic collisions in this system. And then I will construct a new model in which what I do is that I include inelastic terms. And I'll show you that by doing that, I'm able to find a solution in a certain subspace of the parameters. And I will also then use this solution to study some of the quantum properties of the system, like the entanglement or the evolution of the relative population in the modes of the condensate. Then I will go and generalize this model to the multimode case, and I will also be able to include many-body collisions. Initially, the model includes only two-body collisions, but I'll show you how you can include more, and as I said before, the multimode case. So let me start then with, again, the most simple multimode Bose-Einstein condensate. So what we consider is n atoms. And imagine them having two possible internal states. So some atoms can be, so the pointer is in the ground state, and those we will describe by creation and ionization operators, A. And the other species of atoms in our condensate are in the excited state, and those I describe by B and B dagger. So this description of the Bose-Einstein condensate is known as a two-mode approximation. And basically, what this approximation assumes is that the atoms are pretty frozen, so the spatial dependence of the wave function can be sort of ignored. And then the description of the system becomes very, very simple. So the main interactions in this system are an interaction with the laser. So what the laser does is simply takes particles that are, say, in the ground state to the excited state, and vice versa, and two body elastic collisions. So, well, actually, in the next slide, I go into the collisions in more detail. Here, I just forgot to mention that there is an important quantity in the system, which is the relative population. So that's simply the number of atoms in the ground state minus the number of atoms in the excited state. So I'm getting a bit confused with this remote control. OK, so as I said, I wanted to discuss a bit more in detail the elastic collisions. So basically, you can consider atoms in the ground state colliding. So say two particles A collide, and what you have is two particles A coming out of the collision. So the term that describes that is A dagger A, A dagger A. You know, two particles A's are annihilated and two A's are created. Also, atoms in the excited state can collide, so you would get a term like that. And you can also have atoms in the ground state colliding with atoms in the excited state, and you get a term like this, in which, again, you get, after the collision, one in the ground state and the other one in the excited state. OK, so another possible realization of this same mathematical model is the double well Bose-Einstein condensate. So here what you have is a two-well potential, and you have some particles trapped in one of the wells, so we call that well A. And again, A dagger A describes the particles in this well. And the second well with particles, again, which are now described by B dagger, by creation and annihilation operators B. And what you have, so you have these particles can collide. So again, you get a term of fourth order like this one. Particles in well B can also collide, which give rise to that term. And you have a tunneling barrier, which allows some of the atoms, and we consider single interactions first, that go from this well into that one and the other way around. So that's this type of terms. Remember last time, in the last slide, these terms, well, two slides ago, corresponded to the interaction with the laser. So that I call the Josephson type interaction in these both models when I want to talk in general. And the wave functions of the atoms overlap in some region. And in that region, you can also have atoms from well A colliding with atoms from well B. And those give you the other, like, interspecies collisions. So the interactions in this model are quite simple. OK, so the Hamiltonian that's used to describe the system looks like this. So we have the free energy of the particles in both wells, or in both species of atoms. Then you have the Josephson type interaction. Remember, this is the interaction with the laser, or the tunneling barrier. And then you have elastic collisions of the same species and different species. So what I can do is just add a constant term to this Hamiltonian, which is proportional to the number of atoms and the number of atoms squared. And in detail, the term looks something like that. And I define these new variables, big omega and the detuning delta omega, which is the difference of frequencies of the atoms, say, in the ground state and the excited state. I assume that so these parameters here are related to the probability of collisions for the atoms, so they're the scattering rates. And I assume that they're the same for A's and B's. So this is a common assumption made in Bose-Einstein condensates. And well, this is useful just to rewrite the Hamiltonian in this way. So this would be, for example, in the case of the two well Bose-Einstein condensate, this delta omega is the energy difference between the wells. This is the energy difference between the internal degrees of freedom in the case of the two particles. And I wanted to show, I could have started there with a Hamiltonian, but I did it the other way around, because here, only the collisions between different types of particles appear. And I just wanted to make it clear that the collisions between same particles are also in the Hamiltonian, only that they have been absorbed in this constant. Okay? So this Hamiltonian was introduced by Milburn and his group, and then used by Sirac and so to discuss things like entanglement. The point about this Hamiltonian is that it has no exact analytical solution. So what can be done exactly is diagonalized by numerical means, and that's what's done, and this is how people find the ground state. Sometimes the Bethe assets is also used to find the first excited state. And well, usually I've seen in papers that the studies, numerical studies of the properties of this system are done to, I don't know, up to 100 particles and on that order, right? Okay. So let me then now throw an idea. What if we consider in the Hamiltonian inelastic collisions as well? So remember, let's first think about the Hamiltonian in which I'm discussing one single well with particles in two different states, right? So remember that this system is interacting with a laser. So it's not strange to think that one could have a process in which, say, two particles in the ground state collide, absorb a photon from the field, and then two particles come out, but one is in the ground state and the other one is in the excited state. Or both particles come out in the excited state and be absorbed two photons, for example, right? So another sort of interaction you could have is the other way around. Two particles in the excited state colliding, and during the collision, the extra energy goes out and becomes part of the field. Okay, so this would be if you think of two internal levels. But now imagine the two well condensate. Well, in that case, those terms are even more natural, because remember that there is a region where the wave functions in, overlap. And in that region, you can have collisions between particles of well A and well B. And what the Hamiltonian usually assumes is that after that collision, you have again one particle in well A and one particle in well B. Why don't you have interactions in which both end in well A or both well end in well B? So if you looked at the Hamiltonian from a mathematical point of view, you would immediately say, okay, these terms are missing. And then, well, my first worry was, well, maybe there is something that forbids these terms from occurring, but I kind of studied it in more detail and I found that no, so somehow those terms are missing in the description of the system. Okay, so would including this sort of, I mean, we already have a Hamiltonian which we cannot solve exactly an analytical, so including, maybe one would guess that including these terms makes things more complicated. So let me make a bit more comments on these inelastic, well, in general, inelastic collisions in a Bose-Einstein condensate. So these processes are very well known to occur because they give rise to particle loss in Bose-Einstein condensate. So that the particle loss is kind of the number one worry of people in the lab producing Bose-Einstein condensates. They lose the particles, and that's a big problem. So they try to suppress inelastic processes as much as they can. So the best known inelastic processes is background collisions. So you have your condensate, but you have a background, I don't know, molecules and so on, and they collide, they take energy from these usually thermal molecules, and this extra energy makes the particles be lost from the trap. Another very well known inelastic process is three-body recombination. So three atoms collide and they form a molecule, but the trapping potential doesn't see this molecule anymore, it doesn't trap it, and they lose the three particles in this way. Another possible inelastic process is that particles, when they collide, usually they have a whole energy structure, so they can go to any other internal level, which is no longer trapped by the potential, and they also lose it like that. And then two more processes that are closely related to the one I'm discussing here. One is spin exchange. So basically, during the collision, the internal degrees of freedom of the collision change. And what usually is known to happen in this case is that this recombination energy, I mean, if this recombination energy is larger than the trapping potential, the particle is lost. And this is seen to occur all the time, right? And very much related to that is a dipole relaxation, in which, because of the dipole interaction of the particles, also there's a change in the internal degree of freedom. And again, if this energy is larger than the trapping potential, the particle is lost. Okay, so in terms of losses, in elastical processes, in real Bose-Einstein condensates are very well known to occur. But what happens if there is an elastic collision, but the recombination energy is not enough for the particle to be lost from the potential? So that is something that nobody ever considered before, right? And well, there is a probability of them occurring, right? So why haven't they been studied? Well, I think theoretically, maybe the Hamiltonian is complicated enough by considering elastic collisions. And one might think that including inelastic processes just complicate things further. So that could be a reason. One is that just these terms were somehow neglected for some reason. And experimentally, I went to visit two experimental groups in Germany. And I talked and I asked them all kinds of things to see if they have observed these processes. And they said, well, actually, we haven't looked for them, because since they don't give rise to losses, they're not considered in the theoretical models, there's really no way we can know they're occurring. So if you want us to see if they occur or not, you have to design an experiment in which we would see what are the effects of these collisions in the system. And that's precisely what I'm going to show you today. So I will present at the end of this talk some predictions, or well, towards the end, of how, if you wanted to make an experiment to make a check if these inelastic collisions, which do not give rise to loss, how would they look like, and how could you know if they're there or not? So that's just repeating that. So now I propose a new model. Yes. Sure.
So you mean the experimenters, they don't give rise to particle losses, like they don't give rise to particle loss, but it's, they can't register, it can't be recorded, right? They do, when experimentally they do give rise to particle loss.
Yes.
But it can't be registered or it can't be recorded. There's no way experimenters can determine that they give rise to particle loss. So
the process is known to occur. Okay.
Yeah, so there is a particle loss which is happening experimentally.
Yes, but you can, okay, so.
But you can't register and you don't get to know, because I was doing some experiments with BEC. I've done some experiments. So in that sense, when you are having a BEC, when you're forming a BEC, so there's always this interactions like the three-body, two-body collisions happening, and then as you said, there's also molecules which happens in the first part presence, what they call. So atoms are always lost throughout the process, but the moment you make a measurement, the moment you register a BEC, you just don't know how many atoms are lost, what's happening. So I think that the sentence that they don't give rise to particle loss doesn't fit in there is what I mean. There is a particle loss, you can't
fit in. No, but what I meant is you can have the interaction there, but the recombination energy is not larger than the trapping potential, so the inelastic process occurs, but you don't lose the particles. Okay?
Again,
there's, okay, so this is, like I'm considering, why I discussed this particle loss thing is to show you that these processes occur and that they're well characterized when they give rise to particle loss. But that doesn't mean that they always give loss to particle loss. And really my work is to say, let's assume they don't give loss to particle loss, and let's see what would be the effects of these terms in the dynamics of the system and in the other quantum properties of the system. such that you would be able to tell these things are happening in
there. You are assuming the potential is too big for the particles to happen.
Exactly. Yes. Yes. Okay. So that's the model, right? So here we have again the free energy of the particles in the trap, the interaction with the laser or the tunneling barrier, how you like to see that, the elastic collisions, and these two new terms are inelastic terms. So, sorry, it's just I always click on the wrong button. So here I consider that two particles exchange their internal degree of freedom after the collision, and here one. Okay? So that is the old model, and that's the only thing that changes in the new model. Okay? And in the old model, you have these three degrees of freedom, these three parameters are free. And well, we'll see in ours what's the difference. Okay, maybe I am just going the wrong way here, sorry. So again, no, this is just a repetition. The new terms just assume that, say, when you have a collision, and you have a collision in the presence of a field, then the collision can absorb energy or liberate energy into the field. Okay, so the amazing thing is that Hamiltonian, which looks a bit more complicated, does have exact analytical solution. So this is just a quick comment on exact analytical solutions. So, well, like I said at the beginning of this talk, many body systems are relevant really in all areas in physics, but, well, I'm especially interested in them because of their application in quantum information theory. And the thing I don't like about that is that almost no models have exact analytical solutions. You do find them in 1D. In 1D, you have the Ising model, the XY, the Heisenberg model. But really, for more dimensions, you can basically just use numerical and approximate solutions. And these are always restricted by the growing degrees of freedom in your system. And, well, this Bose-Einstein condensate, when you look at the case when you have very few particles, so actually the whole description is not tied to having, I don't know, some condensates can be up to 10 to the 10 particles in the condensate. You can consider three particles in the double well, and still the whole description is the same. And, well, one of the possible implementations of quantum information is in optical lattices, in which you have some potential in which you trap particles. So, I go on clicking on the wrong thing. So this kind of basic element of an optical lattice can be well modeled by these two-mode Bose-Einstein condensate. So one of the things I'm doing with a student right now is using the exact analytical solution that we have to see how we implement 1 and 2 qubit gates in the system. I mean, of course, maybe it's not the best way of doing quantum computation, but well, he's learning quantum gates, and we thought it was a fun little project to do. Okay, so let me show you the solution, because it's incredibly simple. Okay, so consider the following Hamiltonian. So basically, you have the term which is like the free energy of the particles in the trap with some parameter, and the square root of that term. So this term gives you like all the elastic collisions. It looks like you're restricted to have the interparticle collisions to be minus twice as much the collisions of, say, particles. But remember that there is a constant that you can always add or subtract to the Hamiltonian, and that makes this the interparticle collisions more or less, I can manipulate it like I want, so it's basically free. Okay, so the eigenstates of that Hamiltonian, actually, I should mention that at the end, I don't know why I use that notation. There, basically, you have NA particles in well A and NB particles in well B. So this is just another way of writing the same state, right? Where N is the relative population of particles in the two species or in the two wells. And now consider the following unitary transformation. So this is in quantum optics known like the two-mode displacement operator. So it kind of mixes the populations and the modes. And here I have this constant psi, well, this variable, sorry, which is related to two angles, theta and phi. Okay, so the point is that if the parameters of my model satisfy these conditions, then it's very easy to show that if you act on this H0 Hamiltonian with a two-mode displacement operator, you get exactly the model. But these conditions need to be satisfied. And in the next slide, we will see what these conditions mean. And then the solution is simply that. Okay, the two-mode displacement operator acting over the eigenstates of that Hamiltonian. Okay, so let me make a few comments about these things. In the model by Milburn, there were three free parameters. So here you can choose, you have three free parameters as well. And let's choose them to be exactly delta, omega, lambda, and mu, which are the free parameters in Serac's model. If we do that, then these two parameters are totally fixed. You have no freedom. By that I mean if you want to have the exact analytical solution. So this just means that you have a general Hamiltonian and you have an exact analytical solution in a subspace, right? And it's interesting to understand what's the physics of that subspace. So if you see how these things are related, these two parameters correspond to the inelastic collisions. So basically what we find here is that the rate of inelastic collisions depend on the rate of elastic collisions, on how high is the Josephson type interaction, and on the energy difference of the internal states. So, and they depend in such a way that if the rate of elastic collisions is higher, well, the rate of inelastic collisions is also going to be higher. And if the laser intensity is higher as well, this will also make inelastic collisions occur more often. And that's because really what's happening in this particular situation is that there is like an interference between the effects of collisions with, say, the interaction with the laser. So by that, what I mean is that you're really looking at collisions that take place in the presence of a laser. And of course, if the laser field is more intense, this is going to occur more. And also, if the possibility of collisions is higher, inelastic collisions will occur more often. So we looked at the details if these conditions can be met experimentally. And well, I went, like I said, with two groups, and at least from the time I spent there and how they looked at, they didn't see any problem being able to meet these conditions. I mean, it could be that you get some restrictions between the parameters in which experimentalists say, look, this is an impossible situation. So what I mean that doesn't happen here. But now the wonderful thing is that we have all the physics of the system that we want. I mean, we don't only have the ground state, we have the whole spectrum, right? And now one of the nice things is that, say, you say, yeah, but my system maybe doesn't satisfy exactly those solutions. Well, then you can do perturbation theory, but you already have a subspace in which you do have an exact analytical solution, and that's already quite a lot for these sort of systems.
Yeah. So is there a special case to this that reduces to a special case of your model, or are they separate?
Well, you mean for which I have exact analytical solution?
Yeah.
Let me think. The thing is, like, if you want to have these two being equal to zero, that's the old model, then you would have, say, lambda equal to zero, right? For example. Because really, what, like I said, this is really the interaction between the laser at the moment that you have collision. So you see, like, if you turn the laser off, you wouldn't have inelastic collisions. So I don't really think that you can find it like that.
Those are uninteresting.
So the cases in which they coincide are like the Boren cases. So now what we do is that we use this exact analytical solution to make predictions of how the system would behave. So now you're able to kind of, I mean, when I did this work, what I wanted to do is go to the data and simply show that my model works better than the old model. But unfortunately, we couldn't do that because, for example, one of the things I will show you is the evolution of the relative population. And the times at which these experiments have been done are quite short for you to be able to kind of distinguish. So there's other types of predictions that I will show in which you would probably be able to do them with less experimental effort. So unfortunately, I looked all over the place for data, and it was not possible to do so. But this experiment was very like common 5 years ago or something like that. And now that I went around trying to see who would make the experiment, I found that everybody moved to do like now three wells or spin three. I said, God, I'm really, really late now, right? And to convince people to go backwards to old experiments is not so easy. But there is now an experiment in Heidelberg in which they're doing exactly this. And last week, 2 weeks ago, my colleague got in touch with them in a conference in Mexico, and it looks like we got them convinced to try to see what's happening here. They like the model, and so. Well, let me show you the predictions first. So, finding the ground state of the system is now really trivial because the energy is simply these parameters, A1, M, remember M is the relative population, plus A2M squared. And the energy really depends on what are the signs of A1 and A2. So for A2 being positive, the ground state is the closest integer to minus A1 over 2A2. So N has to go from N to minus N because the number of particles is conserved in the Hamiltonian, so either you have them all in one well or all in the other. Those are like the extremes. So if you had something like A1 over 2A2 being larger than N, then you have to kind of, then the ground state is simply M0 equals 2N, okay? I wasn't very clear there. You have a restriction with N, so we have to be careful with that. And when A2 is negative, then N, the ground state will be correspond to all the atoms either on one well, which would be N, or all the atoms in the other well, which corresponds to minus N. So something I found that really gave me kind of a good indication that we might be right is like, the Hamiltonian that Seurat proposed, that Milbert proposed, sorry, as I said, has no exact analytical solution. And in order to study many of the quantum properties, for example, say you want to study entanglement and things like that, what a lot of people do is that they use the coherent state. You know? So the coherent state is basically the two-mode displacement operator that I showed you acting over the state n minus n, which is again having all particles in one state. And the thing is that what people say is like, well, this state describes pretty well what's happening, although we don't know why. And the amazing thing here is that this state is an eigenstate of my Hamiltonian, so maybe we're kind of finding the reason why this actually does describe pretty well what's happening. Okay. So what this is the evolution of the relative population. So we start with all the particles on one side. So that's not an eigenstate of the Hamiltonian. An eigenstate is you acting on that. And we let it evolve. And what you get is the typical like signature of quantum things in quantum optics. It's a collapses and revivals of Rabi oscillations. So this is the model by Milburn. This is what you see. And so again, there's no inelastic collisions. So what we did now is that we added a little bit of inelastic collision. So we considered our model, but not in the regime where you have exact analytical solution. We just add just a little bit to see what happens. And why? Because we want to be, you know, like in case these processes occur there, we want to show that they actually do have important consequences in the evolution of the system. So what you get is a complete distortion of the, you also have collapsing revivals, but the shape changes. Here we even added more, and you see how the thing starts kind of quickly changing a lot. And this is our exact analytical solution. So it's really nice because things become very, very simple mathematically. And what happens is that these collapse and revivals become very symmetrical and very regular, right? When you have exact analytical solution. And actually, this allows us to calculate the period when you have a collapse. And you can also, for example, this relationship here tells us after how many revivals do you have the same pattern repeating. So the nice thing about having an exact analytical solution is that now you can go and predict a bunch of things. So that was a lot of fun to do because we calculated this thing, this thing here, when for different values of A1 and A2, and we would get a number, and the number would tell you after how many collapse revivals you see the same pattern. So let me show you what we get. So for example, here we got that number to be 1, and you see like all the patterns here are exactly the same. And then we took different A1s and A2s, and we calculated this number again, and it gave us a 4. And we were just having fun now counting. You see, this one has the 2 hips here, the small hips. And this is different, that's different, that's different. And after 4 exactly, you come to the same revival. So if A1 over A2 is not a rational number, you will never get the same pattern again. So we were able to do some kind of nice predictions like that. But you see, the most important thing is that you can now compare. Yes?
What is this fine structure? It's going back and forth from type 1 to type 2 rapidly in some oscillations.
Yeah, so basically it's like how, so it depends on what's the say, if you have the 2 wells, what's the height of the barrier, and how, what is the collision rate of your particles. You would start in a situation in which, say, all the particles are in one side, and they start kind of, you know, you get them all going to the other and back, and so, and these are kind of Rabi oscillations, right? But you have interference between different possibilities, and that gives you rise to these funny patterns in which sometimes you have the population changing, and then for some time it doesn't change anymore, and there are these like collapse periods of time, but then the terms start interfering again, and you get these revivals. So this happens in quantum optics very often in very different systems, that you have this sort of collapse, and I think the collapse is something that can happen classically, but the revival is really a signature of quantum stuff going on.
On the vertical axis, you've got these oscillations, but then you've got this constant value. But it's hard, is that a 0? Because in some graphs it looks like it's negative. Is it supposed to be, or is that a plotting?
No, it's always 0.
The previous one to this.
Yeah, it's always 0.
Yeah, you see that there, there's this horizontal line underneath the axis.
Yeah. No, that we did, sorry, I should have said that. That we did it on purpose because we wanted to look into details, and but it's always
that
0.
That really isn't 0.
Yeah. No, I got that same question last time I gave the talk, and I forgot to mention that or to change the graph. It was because we wanted to see some of the details in the patterns, and with the line we couldn't, and I don't know, it was a silly way of fixing it. I should change that. Okay, so another thing that we did is we plotted the probability distribution for different relative populations, so for different n's. And this is what Chirac did for the model, because basically what they wanted to show was that the ground state had a Schrödinger cat sort of structure, because you have the superposition of these two kind of bell-shaped distributions. So these are the results for the model without exact analytical solution of the probability distribution for n. And what we get, so Chirac also gets sometimes one single peak like this, and then you start changing the parameters and it becomes smoothly two peaks, right? And if you keep on changing them in Chirac's model, the peaks just kind of move from one side to another, but you always have two peaks, and that's it. So we start doing the same thing, and we have one peak. Now, when we have inelastic collisions, not when we have the solution, only when we have inelastic collisions, we change the parameters, and we obtain two peaks smoothly again. But you see the distribution is a little bit deformed. It's not these kind of bell things anymore. They're a bit different. And you go on changing the parameters, and then you get three and four. And actually, you start getting more of these contributions. So that's really a big difference with the previous model. So in the previous, without the inelastic collisions, you only have two peaks. But with the inelastic collisions, you start having more. So that would also be a way of distinguishing between the models experimentally. And the interesting thing is that when you consider the exact analytical solution and you make the same experiment, then the transitions between one peak and two peaks and three peaks are totally abrupt. They're like incredibly abrupt. And the reason why that's happening is because these changes correspond to energy level crossings. So somehow you have the parameter space, and you can go to different structures of your ground state by changing the parameters. But if you do so along trajectories which correspond to the regions where you have exact analytical solution, then you're kind of hitting all the time these, well, phase transitions. Some people don't like to call phase transitions when you have energy crossing. That really kind of depends. And since it's not my field, I better clarify. It's a first order phase transition or simply a level crossing. So that is something that you would be able to distinguish clearly. The other thing we calculated is entanglement. So in this case, you can simply use the von Neumann entropy because you consider the whole system to be in a pure state, and you look at entanglement between the particles in one of the wells with the particles in the other well. And well, I really like this part of our work because we were able to really see details of the, like, what's the role of collisions in entanglement. So let me explain our results. So what we get is that, say you start here, this is related to the laser intensity. So say you have the laser off. So there's no entanglement between the two wells. And then you put the laser on, or you lower the tunneling barrier, and things start getting entangled. And there is a maximum around pi over 2 that's really corresponding to the maximal intensity of the laser. So that's kind of this axis. So that one is obviously entanglement. And then M is to do the same analysis, but for different ground states. And what we find is also that the entanglement is maximum when M is zero or close to zero. So that means that the collision rate is comparable to the energy difference between the system. That's when you get this N equal to zero. But there are some details that I'm going to show you in the next slide. The other thing we saw is what happens with number of particles. And entanglement always grows when you have more particles.
So you said you have two potential, and with the laser you change the potential barrier.
Sorry?
So you have two potentials,
yes,
and you, with the laser you change the barrier, and you
yes,
change
yes,
the barrier between the,
yes,
the two of them.
Yes.
So in each potentials you have atoms or particles of different modes, or they're mixed?
No, well, if you look at that realization of the system, you have just the two wells and particles in each well.
So is it, that's very much like, you know, the way you, when you change the barrier between the two potentials, then it's a superfluid state is what it's called for VECs.
Uh-huh.
So where the entanglement, I mean, you might have got it in expression, but I'm not able to understand how it's coming, because like you have two or you have a number of...
So entanglement is, how is the entanglement between the particles in this well with the particles in that well? So if you have more like tunneling, so that's making your barrier low, you have more entanglement. That's kind of the idea.
Because the way I see, you know, like is the collisions or the interactions between the two particles. So it can be elastic or inelastic collisions or whatever it is.
Uh-huh.
So it can be any of the interactions between the two particles, between the two potential wells. And when you vary, when you increase or decrease the potential, well, it's only the J, I mean, if it,
yeah,
using different terms. So J is what is called the barrier between.
So the thing is that both things play a role in the entanglement. So both, that's exactly what this graph is showing us, that both things are important. So it's, of course, how often your particles collide and make, so say, like, if you start here, you would have, or here, you have regions in which you have little particle interaction, so the entanglement is sort of low. And the more you move towards the center means that you're having particles collide more often. And that favors entanglement.
It's fine, I'll look at it also.
Okay. So let me show you what, so, okay, so we find that basically more particles produces more entanglement, and in general, collisions favor entanglement as well. And you would want to have a laser with which is very little detuned from the energy levels, where that also means like the well is symmetric in the other case. But the nice thing that we found are some details about the collisions. So you see, you have this peak here down, and the peak here corresponds to the case in which the collision rate exceeds the energy difference between the particles. So somehow, if you have more collisions, this always favors entanglement up till you get to that point in which it's equal to the energy difference between the states, and then entanglement goes lower. So this really allows us to see in more detail what's the role of collisions in entanglement in this system.
So is that the dip in the graph?
Yes,
the previous slide?
That corresponds exactly to that point. So I'm going to go a bit faster now to the generalizations, because I have a babysitter, which is Karen, that she was very nice to. I have to thank her for helping me with Leo today, that things got a bit mixed up. But she's helping me until five, so I will hurry. Okay, so so remember how I constructed the exact analytical solution was by considering this Hamiltonian H0, which went up to second order, and this gives you the two body collisions. Well, why not add a third or order term? Because this has, say, the same eigenstate, right? And if you do that and you look at what these terms correspond to after the rotation, what they are the, all of the elastic and inelastic three-body collisions, okay? So, well, and why stop at three? You could do it up to n, all the number of particles. This the eigenstate of this Hamiltonian would be the same. So you can basically, just by adding more terms, construct a model for the Bose-Einstein condensate that includes elastic and inelastic collisions of as many number of interactions as you want. So this really lets you go a step beyond. The Hamiltonian by Milburn, it works in something called the dilute regime, in which you consider that the most important collisions are two-body collisions, and you'd say nothing about three. But because we have three-body recombination, you know that you could have three-body collisions. So this really allows you to go to any kind of number of collisions that you want. And one of the things that a student of mine is doing in Mexico right now is looking what is the role of more body collisions in entanglement. And well, as I said, you also have an exact analytical solution there. But the really interesting generalization is now to consider mormals. So remember that the title of this talk is multimodes, and I have only been talking about two modes, I think, condensate. So there is something called the Stringer representation, which relates creation and annihilation modes for two bosonic modes with the SU2 algebra. So if you take that and you look at commutations relations between the J's, using the commutation relations between A's and B, you'll see that that satisfies an SU2 algebra. So what's really behind the model that I just showed you is the SU2 algebra. And basically what I did, and that's what I really did to solve this whole thing, is that I started with the diagonal elements of the SU2 algebra, and then I used the most general rotation in that algebra, and I produced a Hamiltonian, which from the beginning I knew had exact analytical solution. And I mean, I'm telling you here like all my tricks. And then what I did is that I saw that the terms that I got by doing that were relevant from the physical point of view. But that idea lets you extend what we did to n-mode bosons and condensates, because what, and this is work that I'm doing right now with José Ignacio Latorre from Barcelona, is that now, for example, for SU3, what you would do is consider H0 as a polynomial of order n of the generators of the SU3 algebra, which in this case are 2. And then you rotate that with the most general rotation of SU3, which of course now has more angles. The Hamiltonian is horrible, but what we're able to describe now with an exact analytical solution is 3 Bose-Einstein condensates in a ring in which they all can tunnel, and you have all elastic and inelastic collisions. And that is a very fashionable model right now. So I am not late with that one, you know? So that's also, well, it's also known like the spin 1 Bose-Einstein condensate. So basically, in the realization in which you have one single well, you can consider that you have 3 internal degrees of freedom. So that is something that theoretically and experimentally is very fashionable these days. But then you don't need to stop in SU2 and SU3. You can do it for SUN. Of course, it gets horrible mathematically, but in principle, you can do it. And I will skip the part. You can also look at spin 1/2 systems, but I will jump that because of time. And well, my conclusion is simply that I showed you one way of constructing multimode Bose-Einstein condensates, which have exact analytical solution. And we studied analytically the properties of the system, and I showed you that these inelastic terms do have important effects in the evolution and the quantum properties of the system. And I think the most important point about the talk is that including these terms, which are relevant from a physical point of view, make the mathematical problem simpler, not more complicated like one might have been worried about in the first instance. And well, I showed you how to generalize that to get many particle interactions. And what I want to do right now, the most important thing is to get some experimental corroboration of that. So I'm working with these groups in Germany and trying to see if they can compare the two models and see if our model describes things better. And as I said, we're doing in detail the 3-mode Bose-Einstein condensate thing right now. And, well, I also mentioned these other projects with the students of looking at the effects of multiparticle interactions. And, well, we want to study now the case in which you do have loss as a decoherence process. So that's it.
You said you could use perturbation methods to look at the cases where you went away from the particular parameter space of the exact analytical solution. Have you done any of that so far?
No.
Is there any reason to think that there's something especially simple about this
case theoretically, it's making it more complicated, but interesting will happen when you put it away.
Well, that's more, so perturbation theory is something that I like know very little about it, and that comment came more from once I presented this talk to some experts in perturbation theory in Germany, and what they said was that you usually get very good results when you do it close enough to where you have the solution. But they found it very interesting that you actually do have a whole region for which you have a solution. So that's the most difficult thing. And then once you have that, then, well, I mean, you can go to several orders. And of course, if you think of a specific situation in which you're very far from that region, it might not be very useful. But it can be quite useful in regions closer to where you have your solution.
One worry might be that in the actual experiments, you wouldn't be exactly on your parameter plate because you have a 3-dimensional parameter.
Yes.
Whereas I think, yeah.
Okay, so what we're doing right now, which is mathematically difficult, but it's the inverse problem. So what we have is that we have this region where you have exact analytical solution, and now we're looking for the exact shape of the potential that for which you would have this solution. We're doing this in the two well. And this is basically because experimentally they can really make almost any potential you want. So if we solve the inverse problem, we're then able to just tell experimentalists, look, prepare this potential, and then you can make all these experiments with something that you know you have access to all the physics. So that's really some project that we already started. Although it looks really hard.
Mm-hmm. I understood you did some numerical explorations of regions that were within elastic collisions, but far away from your...
Yes, very far away,
And so in relation to Lucien's question, it looked like you didn't get qualitatively new things in those regions,
Yes, we did. In the regions far, right?
Far, yeah.
Yeah. So let me show you. Okay, so that is without any, and if you add a little bit.
Oh, sorry, no, I meant qualitatively different from your exact solutions. In other words, introducing inelastic collisions makes a big difference compared to having no inelastic collisions.
I mean, that numerical work is all within the context of your model, isn't it?
So
the next slide.
Yes.
Yeah, that mu and that's all your model.
Yeah, that is my model.
Not a perturbation.
No, it's the model solved exactly. So you diagonalize the Hamiltonian exactly, but numerical.
Oh.
And that can be done. The thing is, that can be done for the other case as well. But the thing is that when you do numerics, you're restricted by the number of particles. And you get numbers, but you don't really know more where they come from. You cannot push things. You cannot push into deeper questions.
But isn't this numerical solution for values of the parameters in Delphi in your special three-dimensional subset?
What do you mean, sorry?
Well, you had three parameters that
yes.
you solved exactly.
Yes.
The other two had to be tied to
yeah. Yes.
So have you explored
so this
maybe
is
all five independent and seeing whether one's
Okay, so we didn't do that because what we wanted to do is we wanted to leave those three the same and change the other two to see how big the differences were in the behavior of the system.
So then you're off.
Yes, so that's what we did. So that is that's an example. And that's another example.
All right, so that's not in your model. That's your model of perturbation.
Well, no, that's my model, I don't know what we want to call it. This is not a region where I have exact analytical solution. This is just exact diagonalization of the Hamiltonian by numerical means. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And you see that the inelastic collisions have important consequences, right?
Right, but it looks something like what you got when you have the exact analytic solution.
So, so then it starts changing. So you can see this is all by the same parameters, but more inelastic collisions. So it starts changing, and then it becomes very regular. So the big difference is from that, so see the time scale is 50,
right.
To that is the time scale. It changed
right.
A lot, right? Yeah. It becomes regular, periodic. That's where you can find an exact analytical solution. So, well, I'll excuse myself because I have to go from there. But if anybody has any other questions, you can ask me in a moment, OK?
I'll be around.
Thank you.